This episode, Once Upon a Weirdness Magnet, issue number 6. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we're finding our joy as we continue our coverage of one of my all-time favorite characters and comic book series, Blue Devil. Today, we're specifically covering Blue Devil issue number 6 from 1984. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I am not doing this alone. I'm once again joined by my own personal weirdness magnet, Mr. Diavolo Frank. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing great. We just finished having a fun little chat, you know, being buddies and enjoying ourselves. And now we're going to dig into one of our mutual favorite comic book series. You know, I'm in a pretty happy place going into this thing.
This is also weird. We're a real life Norm and Dan, I think, maybe, perhaps. Wow, I didn't get any laugh out of him from that, folks. That means he hates me from the bottom of his soul. So, Frank,
it's not so much that. It's just I don't want to set you up. So we're going to go through this issue. Love the series. Going to be happy about it. But I don't want to set you up for expectations that I won't be able to meet.
Okay, fair enough. So the big change this issue. This is issue 6. This is you know, we've finished the first half of the year. This is a big one because this is Paris Cullen's last issue as the regular monthly artist. We will see him again in the Summer Fun Annual, but this is it, folks. Now he'll continue to do covers. And there is some pretty cool art coming up, but this is the last one with the original team together. Now, we do have a different inker this time. We have Ernie Colone, who, of course, had a very long-standing relationship with Mishkin and Cohn from their Amethyst work. I don't know about you, Frank. Initially, you and I talked about this off the air last time. You know, we're losing Gary Martin as the inker, and it's Ernie Colone. It's going to be different. And I was kind of hesitant and was a little disappointed. But actually, as I read this issue, and I've read it several times now since getting preparation, I'm actually pretty thrilled with Ernie's an inker. I'm not saying he's better than Gary Martin, but he's different, but he brings a lot to this issue. So, you know, big picture, how do you feel about this one? Are you happy with the inking, or did it just take you completely out of it?
Well, I mean, I figured we'd talk about the comic book and then kind of get into that stuff. But what I will say is, again, off air, we were talking about how I, for the most part, no longer have comic book boxes. I have bookshelves, and my comics are on bookshelves. I can go and pull out whatever comic book I want to, whenever I want to, and slide it right back. It's so nice and neat and easy. And so when I went to get my Blue Devil the last time recorded, I accidentally pulled 2 issues. I pulled 5 and 6 out. And so I made a point of giving 6 a toss, you know, just, you know, oh yeah, 6. I don't remember this that well. It's like, this looks a lot different than the previous issues we've been looking at. And I was like, we're going to be talking about this issue. This is definitely something, the art of this issue is not what it was previously. Good, bad, different. It's definitely different.
Okay. Fair. I will show my hand early. I don't care. As a kid, I loved this issue so much. It was probably my favorite issue after issue number 1. Like, issue number 1 holds a special place. After that, this was probably my favorite issue. And reading this, again, I went in kind of expecting not to be too excited. I think it still holds up. I love this issue top to bottom. I think it's absolutely zany. It's crazy. All of this fun for 75 cents, I think that is, it's criminally cheap. It's unbelievable. And I love this issue. And I'm probably not going to be very impartial as we get into it.
Well, you know, I've been triangulating. I've been looking at dates and times with Mike's Amazing World. And I'm thinking this was actually my first issue of Blue Devil.
Oh, you're so full of crap.
Yeah, I am. but what I will say is this was definitely part of the run of issues that I got at the flea market. It was among the early issues that I got. I think I was more or less taking them in sequential order at this point. So it was definitely a memory for me having gotten this one, taking it home, read it. It's clearly a part of my childhood for sure.
Awesome. Well, I hope some of that sparkle comes through. We'll see. But before we get into all that, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from in the InStockTrades library, and usually to be tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. I picked a specific trade paperback called Hulk Joe Fix-It Trade Paperback. And this is obviously Peter David doing the Hulk, but it's not the original run of Hulk. It's a more recent miniseries called Joe Fix-It. It was a 5-issue miniseries. They also threw in issue 347 of Incredible Hulk. And it's basically Peter David came back to the book. And listen to this creative team. Peter David writing Hulk, which is a win. Artist Yildiray Sanar. If you're not familiar with him, I freaking love his work. I found him on the New 52 Firestorm, which was a terrible book, but amazing artwork. He's an amazing artist. And then the cover is by Cully Hamner. I mean, it's a win all the way around. It's 136 pages. It's full color, soft cover, normally retails for $17.99. You can get it for 43% off, so it's only $10.25. And I forgot to tell you the whole reason I picked it. The whole reason I picked it is because in this issue of Blue Devil, they go to Las Vegas. And of course, Joe Fixit's big locale was Las Vegas. So look at that. $10.25 for a 6 issues by Peter David with amazing art. It's totally a steal. So what'd you happen to bring this time, buddy?
Well, I got to be honest with you. When I saw you'd pick Peter David, Joe Fixit, there was a part of me that wanted to like just double down on it and do like the one of the Peter David omnibuses that featured the original run of Joe Fixit stuff with the Jeff Pervez artwork.
Yep.
But I thought that'd be too much of a cheat. But it is a shame because, you know, we've recently lost Peter David.
Yep.
And I've felt that loss because I saw him at a panel at San Diego 2000. I got to interview him about a decade back. It's so cool to sit next to somebody that you admire, one of the best writers the comic books ever had, and you're shooting the breeze. And then Barry Boswick shows up because Peter David's wife won his underwear at an auction, his signed underwear at an auction related to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And so there's just all these good vibes with Peter David. I did lose track of him over the years. And so even before he passed, I started going back and I've been collecting like the Soul Searchers and Company collections, Captain Marvel Omnibus, and trying to get some of that stuff that I missed out on because I just wasn't reading his stuff for a while there. But I decided not to go with the Peter David thing because I just thought it'd be too much of riding your coattails. So instead what I went with was the Victories Omnibus. Not long from now, all that will stand between you and evil are the victories. Heroes sworn to protect us from crime, corruption, and the weird designer drug known as Float. In this complete collection of Eisner Award-winning Power co-creator Michael Avon Oeming's hit superhero series, we follow the mature and bizarre lives of heroes and gods as they fight against the villains, conspirators, and powers that plague their city while battling the demons that haunt their souls. Collects the Victories trade paperbacks, volumes 1-4. So this is 4 trade paperbacks. Published by Dark Horse, 576 pages total on a soft cover. This was already a steal at its list price of $29.99, but In-Stock Trades is giving it to you for $19.19 at a savings of 36%. And jeez, typically, yeah, that's crazy. A great deal. One of the things too is I have not read my Soul Soldiers and Company. I have not read my Captain Marvel, so I can't recommend the thing that I haven't read, even though I have full expectations that it's good or I wouldn't have bought a stinking omnibus. But with the case of the Victories, I was reading them when they were, the individual trades were coming out. Usually on the Blue Devil show, I try to recommend something that is more Blue Devil like, you know, like light adventure kind of thing. This is not that. This is dark. And there's a lot of stories where it's like, oh God, they're doing the grim dark thing and being edgy and stuff. What's interesting about this story is it is dark, but it's also written with empathy. Like this is looking at what kind of traumas would lead somebody to be superheroes and supervillains. And instead of being like, who can do the darkest, most twisted stuff? It's like, what did this mean for this person as a person and what did they have to go through? And you still have great action and it's still lots of cool stuff. You're still very much still in that genre setting, you know, urban vigilantes and things like that. But it's sort of like Daredevil after you've gone through some therapy.
You know? Okay.
So it's a little different. And Oeming's art is, you know, it's not like super detailed, but it's very iconic. And if you like it, you like it. I've dug his stuff since he was doing the American version of the Judge Dredd book with Andy Helfer. So I love looking at it. And I was just really surprised at how well written this was for a person that's more known for their artwork. But when he comes out to write, he's coming out swinging. And I definitely recommend it, especially at a price like this.
Wow. Okay. It sounds like it's definitely worth checking out. So that's Victory's Omnibus, folks. Again, $19.19 for 576 pages. That's astonishing. That is amazing. That's definitely worth checking out.
It's 4 trade paperbacks for $20. Right. What a deal.
I know. That's insane. So, folks, for these and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the shows on the network, the best way to support them is by visiting our Patreon. Again, that's patreon.com/FW Podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And in certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to Michael Salko, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison, and some weirdo named Diablo Frank. Again, folks, please visit the Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcast. Now, everyone remember, we are here to not just represent Frank and I's ideas, because that's just a foolish venture. We're here to represent the entire geeky community and celebrate the things that we love. So we want to hear your thoughts, share your opinions on everyone's favorite Weirdness Magnet, Blue Devil. Speaking of which, Weirdness Magnet, it's going to get talked about, this issue. So the best way to be part of the conversation is in the comments section on our website. So just visit fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts on the show post for this episode, and I will read your comments. Frank and I will. After every single Blue Devil episode. So after we get done with our talking about issue number 6, we're going to talk about your feedback you left on issue number 5. Now, you can also find us in other places on social media. You can find us on X or Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. So there we go. But now, Frank, it is time to talk about our beloved, and I do mean our, get on the bus, sir, Blue Devil number 6, published by DC Comics, cover dated November 1984, on the shelves August 16th, 1984. I must have rode my bicycle up to the convenience store to get this thing, man. Cover 75 cents, and the cover is by Paris Collins. You want to describe the cover for us?
Yes. We see a beat cop from behind holding a notepad asking for a believable story about how Dan and his new friends managed to wreck the Las Vegas casino pit they're all standing in. Dan is pouting with his arms crossed as small machines fly around him like insects. Those friends are orange aliens, one about 3 feet tall, wearing an Orko elf hat, and the other is a towering Hulk, both playing dumb for the cop. Further in the background, in monochrome, are some showgirls, and our cameraman, Norm, doubled over in laughter.
I freaking love this cover. I mean, it literally tells a whole story. Like, if you didn't even have the issue, and this was just like a commission he did or something like this, it tells you the whole story. You know, you can see the two aliens, which are named Lenny and George. You can tell that, like you said, they're guilty. They've got the, like, I don't know, expression about the chaos, trying to play dumb. The casino's completely trashed. Blue Devil is literally steaming. He's so mad. You can see the steam lines coming off his head. The little flying robots around Blue Devil do look like flies, right? He's also, you didn't mention, Blue Devil's actually got his foot propped up. He's standing on two unconscious goons. So you know somehow he's like captured these guys. I love Norm. Norm is literally bent over. He's cackling so hard. And the cop's dialogue is just perfect. And I love me a word balloon on a cover anyway. So I love that this tells a whole story. I think it's wonderful. So you shared the facts of the cover. What's your impression of the cover?
Well, like you, I love a word balloon. You know, we read comics for stories and we like our covers to tell a story as well, and it definitely gives you a good overview of everything that happens in the event. You know, all the events are covered here in retrospect. You kind of know where they're ending up, and then you're going to spend the rest of the issue figuring out how they got to the places on the cover, which is a cool idea. It's very orange. There's a lot of orange. And then what's not orange is purple. And so there's a lot of detail here that I think gets lost because they just, like, you know, fill, call it a day.
It's interesting because I'm looking at the physical comic that I've got. By the way, I've got a physical issue right here in my custom bound edition, which is gorgeous. But I've got the physical comic, and I'm looking at the digital version on DC Infinite. And I don't like to say this very often because I like the physical comics, but dang, the physical comic, I don't know whether it's just aged over the years or it was poor printing to start with, but the colors are so muddy on the cover that, like, you mentioned those little things buzzing around Blue Devil. They just look like blobs. They just look like gray blobs. Whereas on the digital version, you can see all the incredible line work that Paris Collins put into those little flying guys. You know, the trunks that Lenny's wearing just look like black blobs, but they're actually green in the digital version. You can see all the line work. You can see all the folds of the cloth. I mean, it's just really sad that the physical comic looks really poor in comparison to the digital. And it's interesting you mentioned the purple. Like, the purple is muted much more on the digital. It's really more a lot of orange and blue, which are nicely complementary colors, by the way. But the digital is a very different experience. I'm going to post these on social media. By the way, there's a comment later in the show that I'm just going to address up front. This says, like, they wish we had an image gallery for these episodes. Just if you guys don't know, I actually post all the relevant images that Frank and I are going to talk about. I post them on social media the week before this episode even drops. So if you go out and look at Once Upon a Geek on, you know, X or Blue Sky or Facebook or Instagram, whatever, this cover is going to be out there. A lot of the images we're going to talk about inside are going to be there. And in fact, in the show notes, if you click in your podcast player, I actually have a link that'll take you directly into those social media posts. So So trying to make it easy for you. But yeah, there's no image gallery, but I put it all out there for you. So you're going to see this cover, and I'll put out there, maybe I'll put the, if I can get a good picture of the physical comic and the digital, you can see the comparison, because it's night and day.
Well, just to go over my biases too.
Okay.
The way I see it, if I've got a script and I've got finished artwork and I've got lettering, then I've got a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
I like color comic books. Like Brian Bolland's about to recolor his Bishop and the Actress material. And if I have the opportunity, I'm going to get the color version. As much as I love his line work, I also think he does great coloring, and I would rather see the material in color. But if I don't have color, just like with the showcase presents or the mm-hmm. Marvel Essentials, I've still got a full comic book. With or without the color. So that there's a hierarchy. I'm probably one of the rare people that will put letterers above colorists in my hierarchy of what I need for a good comic book. Most of the time, I'm perfectly content with whatever coloring I get. So it's never like a real big deal breaker. I like it in color versus not in color. But as far as there's not a lot of books where I'm like, I'm going to buy that book just for the coloring. But I have to say, like, I'm looking at this and like with better coloring, I'm sure I would have enjoyed this more with more ambitious coloring. And we talked before about how sometimes you need to separate because the artwork is so detailed that it would be like too many lines for you to comprehend what you were looking at if the coloring weren't differentiating them in a way by like having these monochromatic backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's kind of sludgy. It's just, I don't think this is particularly good coloring, and I don't usually call out coloring. The other thing I do wonder about, though, is that I wonder if DC was starting to experiment with the mirror web process at this point, where they were using the plastic plates for their printing. Because as you noted, it's not just the coloring. Even the line work, the blacks aren't very black. They're sort of this gray color, and everything's sort of muted and fuzzy. And I'm wondering if this wasn't one of their early trial runs for those rubber plates that ended up like being like a scandal of DC Comics, because you've got a few years worth of books where people just like hold their nose when they look at the art reproduction in that era.
It could be, yeah, because I remember leading it, a lot of it had to do with magenta. Like, I remember magenta was out of control during that process. The flexographic process, I think, is what it was called, maybe.
Okay, maybe it was flexographic. I, you know, we're very much old in where we're worrying about those distinctions. But yeah, there were different processes they were using to try to do different types of printing, mm-hmm. even while still using new print. But they wanted the newsprint to look more like their more upgraded stuff to attract readers, and or just to save money. And some bad things happened mostly at DC. It seems like Marvel like stepped back and let DC make all the mistakes, and then they could like benefit from their learning process. And it was DC that just kept, you know, stepping on rakes, it seemed like.
Yeah, that's good. I like the stepping on rakes. That's good. I hear what you're saying about the monotone backgrounds, and while it would be fun to see them fully colored out, I think it's actually effective to use the monochromatic backgrounds to make the important things pop. Because we talked about this last issue too, because it's just like, if you color everything, you don't know where to put the eye, especially when Paris makes every inch of the cover so detailed. So I'm good with it. I'm good with this. So
where my argument is, again, all that orange. And there's no differentiation. All the orange is the exact same shade of orange. So that means at least the full third of the cover is just orange alien people. I think under those circumstances, it's okay to have some more colors, because the figure colors are so flat that you don't need to separate them the way that you would if the coloring on the figures were better, and the art isn't quite as ornate as it was in the previous issues. So I don't think it'd be quite as overwhelming this time as it was in previous times.
Yeah, you may be right. I mean, you're usually wrong, but you might be this time. I don't know. So at the end of it, I do love just the cover in general. This cover sums up like the exact storytelling style I want for Blue Devil. You know, action, funny, silly, but Blue Devil looks, you know, very cool throughout it. This is the kind of Blue Devil stuff I want to see. So, all right, well, let's get inside. What do you say?
Well, okay, inside front cover. Did you ever get to play the Mario Brothers game?
I am not a video game guy. Like, I literally have a handicap where I suck at video games. So this is the original Atari. It says Atari Mario Brothers, interestingly. So I guess it's not original. It would have been Nintendo first. Nintendo wasn't even around at this point. So I guess this would have been the first version. Is that right?
Presumably. Because my question, like, I played Donkey Kong in the arcade, and it was one of the first games I was halfway good at. And so I could feed it a quarter and actually spend some time doing it. And so I thoroughly enjoyed Donkey Kong. And I tried several of the Donkey Kong sequels, in the arcade. When we got a ColecoVision in the home, we had Donkey Kong. So me and my stepfather both played Donkey Kong a considerable amount of time. But for whatever reason, I never saw this at the arcade. We never had a cartridge of this. We skipped right to, actually, it was Donkey Kong 3, because it was the one with Stanley and his dumb gas gun where he's like supposed to be spraying insects that Donkey Kong's sending at him. I don't know what they were doing there. And then, of course, Super Mario Brothers, when it showed up in the arcade, was a revelation. You had the siren call of the theme song. And it's just weird to me because this is apparently the original Mario Brothers game, the introduction of Luigi. And it's like, and there's even a comic book, you know, there's a little comic story that goes with my comic book to tell the story of Super of regular Mario Brothers. And I have no experience with this whatsoever. I have no recollection of ever seeing this. Maybe I think even like I'm looking at the turtles coming out of the pipes and I'm thinking, well, maybe that was a thing, but they did the same thing in Super Mario Brothers. So I feel like this is this weird thing where I don't really know anybody who ever has anything to say about Mario Brothers. Like, I don't know anybody who had experience with Mario Brothers. So that's the thing I want to ask our letter hacks, our circuits and sorcery people, for as much longer as we can call them that. If you guys had a regular, basic, original Mario Brothers story, please tell us that story.
I'd love to hear it. I played some video games in the arcade. I had no game system at home ever until the Sega Genesis. And even then, I only bought it just so I could play Justice League Task Force. I'm not kidding. I literally bought Sega Genesis just to play that one Justice League game. That's it. But we grew up with PCs. I had a TRS-80. I had a TI-99. I had a Commodore 64. So any video games I played were computer-based rather than console-based. So I have zero console ability. When my stepson was a young adult and he got his first like PlayStation and stuff like that, I'd play games with him, but he just slaughtered me every time because I just can't do it. But yes, I also echo Frank. I want to hear you folks, especially as we go through here and you see more combo... video game ads. What is your history of video games and these ads from the 80s? That'd be fun to know. All right, so let's talk about the comic. So it is written by Gary Cohn and Dan Mishkin. Penciler is Paris Collins. Inker is Ernie Colon. Again, that's a change. Letter is Bob LaPan. Also a change, but one of my favorite letterers ever. Colorist is Michelle Wolfman. And editor is Alan Gold. The issue itself is called Night on the Town. So my recap is a little longer than I wanted it to be, but I cut it down literally as much as I could. There's just so much that happens here. So we start off on the planet Maldor, and we meet these aliens named George and Lenny. Now, they're spelled weird, but that's how their names sound. They are fleeing from robot cops, their silhouette coincidentally happens to resemble our hero Blue Devil. So our alien protagonists, they crash a science demonstration featuring a device that turns living beings into energy and beams them across the galaxy. Well, chaos ensues, buttons are bumped, and both aliens and six robot cops get zapped across space. Meanwhile, Blue Devil and Norm Paxton, who's our cameraman extraordinaire, are cruising home from Mexico, riding atop Dan's souped-up Trident. They stop at a diner near Las Vegas. Blue Devil orders pie, while Norm calls Marla Bloom. While Marla and crew ditch a swanky Hollywood party and steal the limo from sleazy producer Jock Werner to drive to Dan and Norm's rescue. Later, Norm declares Blue Devil to be a weirdness magnet. This is the first utterance of the phrase, folks. And just to prove the moniker, surprise, the aliens, George and Lenny, burst out of the diner microwave. Yes, you heard me right. They came out of the diner microwave. They then mistake Blue Devil for another RoboCop. The aliens bolt while the actual robot cops follow through chasing George and Lenny. The aliens are nearly caught until a van plows into the RoboCops, and the van happens to be driven by ex-henchmen Smitty and Rojack from issue number 3 of Blue Devil. The aliens join our favorite bumbling henchmen, and everyone heads to Las Vegas. Blue Devil and Norm give chase, but the robot cops self-repair and follow too. So at the casino, George mistakes Blue Devil for one of these robot cops, and he starts a brawl and ends up smashing the slot machines in the process. Smitty and Rojack scoop up as many coins as they can from the slot machines while the robot cops crash the party. The destroyed RoboCops reform into one Megabot and then Minibots and more chaos. Back on Maldor, the demonstration scientists are trying to retrieve everyone who went through to Earth. Well, back in the casino, Blue Devil shoves the RoboCops into a microwave, which sends them back to Maldor. The Las Vegas police arrive, but Norm spins it as an alien invasion was thwarted, and the casino manager, who works for Jock Werner, demands payment. Blue Devil volunteers George and Lenny as bouncers. Then Smitty and Rochek surrender, begging to be arrested just to escape the madness. Marla and crew arrive for a reunion, and Wayne drives everyone home, while Blue Devil and Norm pass out in the backseat. So that is your recap. And it says, next issue, a trip to the Haberdashers, a ride in the country, a date with Sharon. If that's not enough excitement, Cassidy and the Trickster face the menace of Bolt. It's just another day in L.A. Be here. All right. So there we go. So, sir, why don't you start us off? Let's go through your notes and I'll just chime in as we go. What did you think of the issue?
Okay. So as I believe I've already mentioned in the episode, although it might have been offline, I got this one at the flea market. I was getting the book fairly regularly and the book was just going from high to high. I love 3, love 4, love 5. This was my first disappointment. I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it, but it's just like this one just wasn't as good to me as a kid as the other ones had been. So this is the first one where I was like, that one kind of missed a little bit. And you know how it is when you're a kid, there are things you love, and then you get older and you look back and you're like, what was I thinking then? Or there are things that you were just not sophisticated enough to get, and then you go back as an adult, you're like, I missed that. Where more or less coming back to it, I'm the same way. It's like these characters come back again over the course of the series. I'm not happy when they come back. So the part of it is just like me knowing what the future is, that these guys are going to be getting on my nerves, that I sort of resent them reading this first time. It's fine. It's cute. I like it. Okay. But it's not my favorite. And it is a disappointment to me, especially this being Paris's last issue. And of course, when I was reading the book the first time, I didn't keep up with Artis. I didn't know that he was going to be gone. I think it was announced in the letter column. I read letter columns, but it just wasn't absorbing stuff or just wasn't impactful for me. Cause I'm like, I love Paris Collins. It's just like, no, I love Blue Devil. And it just so happens that the person who's drawing Blue Devil is somebody who's doing great work. And I love his work, but I didn't know his name. I didn't keep up with those guys. But I definitely noticed that the book started looking different from this point. And this was the first issue that looked different. And I wanted it to be the same. As simple as that.
No. Okay. I hear you. I completely disagree with you, but I hear you. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. Yours just happens to be wrong. I love the absolute madcap nuttiness of this issue. Like, it starts kind of calm, where Blue Devil and Norm, they're just having a slice of pie, you know? And then the madness ramps up, a couple of weird things happen, and by the end, there is so much chaos going on. At one point, there's all these multiple threads. There's aliens and robots fighting a casino. There's slot machines that have been burst open, and Smitty and Rochek, who are these throwback characters from a couple issues there, are trying to gather all the coins. Blue Devil's fighting Lenny and George, and then he's fighting the robot. It's so chaotic. There's so much stuff going on that I just love it. I think, honestly, this is a high point for the book. Maybe not the highest high, but it is one of the high points for the book. I think this is a fantastic issue. And the whole thing with the mistaken identity, with the robot cops looking like Blue Devil, sure, it's a silly coincidence, but that's what this book is about. This book is about being silly, and I just love that.
I just heard you read a synopsis of this comic book, and yet you're describing things that counter your own synopsis. This book starts out with Lenny and Squiggy, or whatever his name is, Lenny and George. It's them running around for 3 pages, having madcap adventures with Blue Devil-like robots chasing after them. And then you have a splash page with an explosion of Blue Devil and Norm flying against the background of the Blue Devil, which is a very like spirit kind of thing, where the Blue Devil is actually incorporated into the mountain range in the background stuff. This is not a quiet book. It gets quiet for a short period of time and then goes right back being madcap. So I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about Blue Devil and Norm. Yes, they're riding a trident, but they're not in combat or anything. So I think the Norm and Dan segment starts sort of quiet. By the way, let's jump back to what you just said, though. Yes, the splash page featuring Norm and Blue Devil flying on the trident. But yes, the Blue Devil logo in the background, including all the creators etched in stone, very much a nod to Will Eisner's spirit. And it looks gorgeous. I mean, Paris really did a fantastic job on that page. I think it looks great.
Yeah, I love the splash page. And it's interesting, too, because I don't associate Paris Collins with that kind of structure, you know, with that kind of incorporation. And you can clearly see the Ernie Colon in this artwork, especially on this page. Like, the previous pages feel much more like Paris, especially when he's going in his hyper-detailed mode, where this is the first page of the book that you can tell somebody else is inking this, particularly in the way that the feathering is done on Blue Devil. It's just not what you're used to. It's definitely rougher. And it has more of that European quality to it, but I still love it. I think that Cologne does a great job of capturing what I love about Blue Devil, in part because he's getting to go off of the perfect Blue Devil artist's, you know, guidance. He's got the great Van Dyke-y thing, whatever you call that, that Fu Manchu mustache thing he's mm-hmm. got. It's not the perfect idealized horns. It's a little bit more organic looking, but they still look cool. He's got that great expression on his face. I love that his eyebrows are so huge and bushy that it's actually covering the horns. Yeah. And a dynamic pose, cool background. Norm looks like he's about to lose his mind. They love this splash page. Great splash page. And again, talking about being a coloring, a lettering nerd, Bob LePan, of course, has all the bona fides from JLI, but I tend to think of him more about how he's able to do stuff with lettering that implies what's going on in the dialogue so well. And I don't tend to think about him as doing like logos and things like that, but I think the Night on the Town logo looks good. He's got some cool lettering on the robots and how they speak, the malfactors, and mm-hmm. it's all in that like calculator font and stuff. So he's still doing some cool stuff. I love Todd Klein. Klein is still one of the all-time great letterers, but LePan is out there doing some solid work. And I noticed too, like, we don't have Gary Martin in this issue, and of course when we were talking before, we're struggling to remember poor Gary Martin, even though he's also one of the great inkers of all time.
Oh yeah.
Did you happen to notice that in this sort of quasi interlac they actually have his name near the micro beam projector?
Really? I'm trying to look around here.
Look at the platform where the aliens are standing, and right below them you've got all the orange.
It does say Martin. Look at that! On page 2, that's so cool.
Yeah, I just wonder if that's a shout-out, because I don't know.
Oh, it's gotta be.
Put that in there, because it could be LePan like giving a shout-out, or I don't know who's... It could be Paris Cullins giving a shout-out, knowing that his last issue wasn't going to be inked by the guy who'd been partnered with.
It could have been Ernie trying to do tribute to the guy that done the issues before. But either way, it's really cool. And that is very subtle, and I did not catch. There's a lot of little background things in this issue, and I was wondering whether it's Ernie or Paris. Like, for example, page 5. Page 5 is a 9-panel grid, which I love. I love a 9-panel grid. And it's got Blue Devil's typical acrobatics where you get the after images. I love that. And then there's like a couple pages, there's 3 panels where there's a fly just buzzing around. By the way, in the printed comic, you can't even tell what the hell's going on. But in the digital one, especially if you go panel by panel, which, by the way, this issue is meant to go panel by panel. It's so beautiful. You can really see the detail. There's a fly buzzing around, and then, like, the chef smacks the fly with a fly swatter. It's not part of the story. It's just background art stuff. And again, I wonder if that's something that Paris put in, or that's something that Ernie put in, because Ernie's famous for putting all kinds of crazy stuff in. Like, if you ever look at Amethyst, everything is alive. Everything has a face. Everything's doing something. So I do wonder who is responsible for that, but I love those small kind of details they slip in there. It just looks great.
I didn't notice it until you mentioned it, and I still had to look through panel by panel 3 times before I finally found the fly and began to follow the fly. So yes, the newsprint does not communicate that well at all.
No, I didn't get it until I read it in the digital comic. Then it's clear as day what's going on. But then the physical comic, I didn't catch it. I was like, oh, there's a fly swatter. And then beyond that, I couldn't figure it out. Yeah.
One thing too, since you're talking about the differences with the different artists, like those early pages, you can very much see the Paris Cullins, because we've talked a lot, especially in reviewing these comics in podcast form and really scrutinizing them, the just absolute extraordinary amount of detail that Cullins was putting into things, particularly technology. And that's very much present here, but it's one of those deals where, like, when Arthur Adams was first getting started and they'd throw like weird random inkers on top of him, but mm-hmm. he still had all those lines on the page, but you have these bizarre, uncommon interpretations of these lines that are very familiar to you now because you've seen him inked by Terry Austin and people who are more on his wavelength, where Ernie Colon is not somebody you would associate with Arthur Adams, but you've got Paris Cullins doing Arthur Adams level of detailing. And so it's you can still see the details, but it's a little bit askew. So it's just an interesting combination. It's not, I'm not criticizing it. It's just different. Like the line work that I've come to expect from him in previous issues is there, but it's interpreted in a way that I've not seen before. And it's very intriguing. And again, it's got that Spanish or that European quality to it that was not there previously. But what I will say is those super intricate robots mm-hmm. do seem to lack depth. One of the things that Gary Martin was really great about in those issues, and we've talked about this, is you'd have those thick outlines that would really yeah. push them forward, almost making it look like it's embossed on the page, whereas there's not a lot of depth of field here, and so it's really detailed, but they still seem flat, and that's a little disappointing for me.
That's a good point. The thicker line that Gary would have put in would have really benefited here. You're right. Because one of the things, too, about the robots, and this is sad with the newsprint version you lose, is even though they all have the Blue Devil silhouette, again, looking at the digital version, you can really tell that each robot is unique. They have variation in eyes. They have variation in line work. The joints are different. They look really different from each other. And again, you're right. A little more thicker line would have helped them pop. But again, it's, if you got to look at the digital to see how beautiful it is. And again, I'll put some of the stuff on the interwebs. You'll be able to see it there. But just overall, I think we're saying similar things, but you keep trying to lead to a conclusion of it being a lesser quality. I'm trying to say it may not be as great as Gary Martin, but it really is a gorgeous book. I absolutely love it.
It's an interesting combination for sure. I also want to mention that we know that this book was designed to be drawn by Steve Ditko. And we've seen elements of Ditko in previous issues. I think Paris Cullens was either influenced by him or was paying homage to him. And that's still present. But there's a very strong Jack Kirby in this issue, too, that's, I think, unique to the issue, particularly that great big fantastic, again, I have to read it, micro beam projector, the great big device. So it's the great big MacGuffin, but again, just extraordinary levels of detail and cool shading on it and a great sense of how gigantic this thing is. And yet it's surrounded by sort of more Ditko-y, you know, dark dimension type of alien creatures. And then I don't know which one is Lenny and which one's George, but the big guy is both, he's colored like the thing, but he's drawn like one of the mindless ones from Doctor Strange. And I'm just really enjoying the Silver Age Marvel pastiche we're getting here.
Oh, it feels like it for sure. But we've been seeing this, though, issue after issue. I mean, there was the ones in Star Labs we saw that were very similar, where they were doing tests on Blue Devil, and he was surrounded by tons of Kirby tech. So obviously, this is something that Paris enjoys doing. I mean, he goes on to draw the New Gods book. I mean, so clearly, Paris loves Kirby stuff. So you're seeing definitely a big influence there. By the way, you mentioned the aliens. Let's talk about that for a minute here. So it's Lenny and George. If you haven't pieced it together already, it is absolutely a nod to Of Mice and Men, right? Because Lenny and George are the two main characters, or two of the major characters in Of Mice and Men, and you've got sort of that vibe here, where one of them's a little more simple than the other. Now, as a kid, and I think we're both kind of going the same way in this discussion based on what I saw in your notes, I didn't know it was from Of Mice and Men. I thought it was from a Looney Tunes cartoon, with the whole thing where, like, you know, well, which way do we go, George? Which way do we go? You know, or I will love him and hug him and call him George and all that kind of thing. That's what I thought this was a nod to. But it's supposed to be Of Mice and Men. So did you also think this is from a Looney Tunes thing or whatever?
Yeah, I went down the rabbit hole with you because I saw your references to specific Looney Tunes animated features. And so, yeah, okay, I remember that dog. But for some reason in my brain, I keep picturing like a smaller dog, like a Chihuahua type dog, and then a bulldog. And the one is constantly running around the other one and like being its hype man and stuff. And I want to say that was an MGM thing rather than a Warner Brothers thing. I don't even think it's the right association. I think in retrospect that I'm just doing a Mandela effect where I'm combining these things that were disparate. But I always picture those two dogs instead of the dog that you're bringing up from the Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Well, there's two different ones. There's a Tex Avery 19... And this, I'm only getting this from research. I don't know this stuff off the top of my head, folks. But there's a Tex Avery 1940 film called Of Fox and Hounds, which is where you get, which way do we go, George? Which way do we go? Then in the 1943 Bugs Bunny Falling Hare used that same line. Which way do we go, George? Which way do we go? And I think I remember, too, a big bulldog and a bouncy little chihuahua, like you're talking about, saying, which way do we go, George? Like, which way do we go, George? That kind of thing, too. So I think this idea of the George and Lenny kind of concept has been circling around a lot of stuff. Now, whether they all got it from Of Mice and Men or not, I don't know for sure. But it's interesting how all of this is swirling around here. And obviously, it was in the zeitgeist enough for Michigan and Cone to latch onto it for these two characters.
But what's also interesting about this, revisiting this, is that audiences in that time period were simply more literate. Just be honest about it.
Yeah.
And whether it was MGM or whoever, you would have those cartoons that would reference Steinbeck. You know, you'd have cartoons that would reference the classics, you know, the canon and such. And you'd see that represented in these cartoons, and those aren't as well remembered. Like, remember the ones where they'd have a cartoon where it was nothing but the stars of the day, and you'd have Humphrey Bogart.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so we just don't really do that anymore. I think the last time you had something like that was honestly, again, like Tiny Toons when they were doing the stars of the 90s, you know, bringing them in. But you could watch those old time cartoons and you'd get a little bit of the Great Gatsby in here now and again. You know, you get these references and stuff that were clearly targeting the adults who would have been reading those books when they were coming out or were fairly recent releases. And we just don't do that anymore. We don't do that in our culture anymore. We micro niche the stuff where everything's targeted to a specific demographic, this age group, this gender, so on and so forth. And it used to be they'd make these cartoons where you've got a level for the adults, a level for the kids, different levels of literacy and cultural awareness. And we don't have that anymore. And I think part of it is the loss of the monoculture. It used to be we had a situation where everybody watched the same stuff because there was only so much stuff to be had.
True.
And it's great that we are able to create media for specific groups now, but also we don't overlap those groups. And so we're much more siloed than we used to be, where there was a time where you would make a reference to Of Mice and Men and everybody would get it. And you just can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And what I'm thinking about specifically with Of Mice and Men was back in the 90s, John Malkovich had done a TV adaptation with I think Gary Sinise and I think Sherilyn Fenn was in there too. And then they parodied it on Saturday Night Live where it was Chris Farley, like just killing one animal after another, one rabbit after another. And that was part of the joke. And people got the joke because even if they hadn't read Of Mice and Men, it was still part of the monoculture. And we just don't have that anymore.
No, you're right. And like my touch point, like I've never read Of Mice and Men. My touch point is a silly internet show called Con Man, right? With Alan Tudyk, where they did a whole parody of Mice and Men because Lou Ferrigno wanted to play Lenny. You know, it's like that's where my touch point is. You're right, because we're just not as literate of a culture as we used to be. Now, I certainly read a bunch of books, but they're like Doctor Who and Star Trek. I'm not reading the classics. So, yeah. All right. So other things to talk about. I mean, one of the key points of this issue that at the time just seems like a throwaway, but on page 7, Norm refers to Blue Devil as a weirdness magnet. So there we have. That's the introduction of that phrase that is going to follow him, I think, to this day, probably still with Blue Devil. And I love that moment.
I love that it's Norm's moment too, because they made a big deal, especially after the series. Marlowe kind of looms large, Gopher as a huge presence in one period of time after the series ends. So he's sort of part of the legacy of Blue Devil. You got a lot of these people that are from the book that still kind of carry on, but Norm really disappears after the series ends.
Which is a shame, because he's supposed to be the guy that his best friend.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that, you know, we're going back and it's like, wow, that came from Norm. That's cool that, you know, he wasn't Cain and Abel or something like that. And it's such an intrinsic part of the series, the weirdness magnet. Again, you named the, you know, moment of the comic book, the weirdness magnet, and it made perfect sense. That, like, the minute you said it, I totally got what you were going for there. I'm curious. I'm really, like you, I want to see the evolution of this. I want to see where this is going to go forward. But I just love that this is a moment where Norm's just like, yeah, dude, whatever happened on that island, you're just this big weirdness now. You're just constantly attracting weird stuff and you can't help it. And he's like, no, I'm not. And no, the series is going to prove, yes, you are.
Right. An instant later, you know, Lenny and George burst out of a microwave. So, yeah, he says specifically, it's the mixture of magic and science in you has made you a weirdness magnet. You attract all sorts of strange stuff now. So there we go. Love that. Couple other quick things. Just, I have a bunch of rapid fire notes here, so we'll just jump all over the place. One of the jokes in the series, in this issue, is the planet that Lenny and George come from. They get transmissions from Earth, including I Love Lucy, and they say like they actually have religions based around I Love Lucy on their planet of Maldor, which is cute. But I didn't notice until the second or third time reading through, there's a couple of times where the scientists who are doing the demonstration for the MacGuffin beam or whatever, they're saying, instead of saying like, my God, or things like that, he says by Fred or Ethel only knows, which is obviously references to Fred and Ethel from I Love Lucy, which I thought was genius because I did not pick up on those the first time. Really clever the way of Mishkin and Cohen bury that stuff in there.
It's also funny too because they do the whole Legion thing. Like, they're already playing around with interlack alike lettering and stuff, but also they give you a very common name from mid-century 20th century, but they spell it all weird so that it becomes futuristic, just mm-hmm. like, you know, Jim Alon is spelled with G-I-M, but he's Jim, you know?
Right.
There are plenty of Jims in that time period. So that's fun. But we can't really communicate that easily in a podcast. You really have to see it in print. And then you still have to kind of deduce it. So it's a little Easter egg for you to figure out.
fun stuff. And what else? Okay, so our supporting cast, they don't get a lot of moments in this issue, but you do get a page with Marlo and Wayne and Sharon and Gopher all at this Hollywood party. And I do love, because we're starting to see more of Jacques Werner, right? Who's the dillweed who owns Werner Brothers. And I do love that, I guess the point where I'm getting is, I love that they steal his limo. Like, it's totally flip a bird, because he's being an a-hole about Blue Devil, and he's being nasty about Wayne. And then they just up and steal his limo and drive away with it, and he's just, you know, stomping his feet all angry, and it just brings me joy seeing a rich billionaire not get his way.
What's funny to me is this comic book came out over 40 years ago, and yet the current CEO of Warner Brothers is basically this dude. Like, they look alike, they kind of dress alike, they probably act alike. It's just funny. The more things change, the more they stay the same, it seems like.
That is too funny. I like that. Let's see what else. Okay, so we were talking about Norm during the weirdness magnet moment, right? Did you notice that there's a pattern? You probably already read my notes, so maybe you know. There's a pattern on Norm's hat, which was driving me crazy. It took me forever to figure it out. Did you notice the pattern on his hat?
Only from your notes. I agree that by the end, it's sort of a VB or WB, and it seems sort of like they're trying to keep it vague. Like, well, how close do we want to come to calling out our corporate daddy, you know, as Oliver would call it. But since you're talking about the hat, I have to point out in particular page 7, panel 2. So much care is taken in drawing Norm's face in that one particular panel.
Yeah.
Because I have to figure Paris Collins was basing that dude on somebody.
Oh, could be. Could be. Yeah. Could be somebody he knows. Very well. Could be. He's done that. We know he's done that before in other people. So that would make a lot of sense. And that's actually the panel that let me figure out what was on his hat. Yeah. Because the hat's all one color. Well, it's a little bit of green and yellow, but I thought it was an MB for a long time. I thought it was like Marlo Bloom Productions or something. But yeah, it's actually VB for Werner Brothers. But yeah, that's a fantastic panel. Norm looks great. He looks like a real human being.
You know, since I'm keeping track of these pages, you'll also notice like this progressive shift where it goes from more Paris to more Cologne. You know, you can tell where the deadline doom is coming in.
Give me an example.
No, I mean, seriously, like, just if you go page to page, mm-hmm. you know, those early pages, even though you can tell that Cologne did the inking and it's consistent, you can see a lot more Paris on those early pages. But as the book progresses, especially toward the end, you can see more and more Cologne. So it's almost like Paris was able to put more effort into the early part of the book. And then the later part of the book, Cologne's having to come in and fill in more of the gaps. And I'm wondering, too, if the book was behind, if it was a deadline issue, that might also explain why Todd Klein, who's a very, like, particular inker and probably needs a decent lead time, letterer. And then this issue, we've got a different inker and we've got a different letterer. I feel like the dreaded deadline doom is apparent by who's doing the book and how the book looks as it progresses throughout. It's consistent throughout, but I feel like there's more and more Cologne the further we get into the book.
That's fair. I just passed through all the pages. Yeah, that's absolutely fair. And it probably was a late book. I mean, Paris notoriously was always late with his material, and it got worse as time went on. So I think that's absolutely a possibility.
And the other thing, too, is that you see that deep, deep Paris detailing on the cool stuff that he wanted to draw. And then when you're seeing like the regular people, Jacques Werner, the folks at the cafe, suddenly it looks a lot more Cologne.
Yeah. By the way, something that we were going to mention earlier, I'm going backtracking on a previous comment, how we talk about the letters and how great letters are. Letters have to choose where to put the word balloons. That's part of the struggle, is the artist lays out the page, but they don't necessarily know where the word balloon is going to go. So the part of the art of being a letter is knowing where to put the word balloons. And on page 16, there's an interesting thing where clearly Bob LePan felt forced to put the word balloon over something he probably didn't want to do, or maybe he did on purpose, either way. But if you look at the top panel, clearly he's got a word balloon covering Martin's name again. That is clearly the TIN of Martin from that same piece of machinery. And he's either covering it on purpose because he doesn't want it to be so obvious that it's just English, or maybe he felt like that was the best place for the balloon. I'm not sure.
But since you're mentioning that, I do have to say, reading through this issue, and it's something, it's really getting to be a lost art, you know. I never had any question what balloon I'm supposed to be reading next, what panel I'm supposed to be reading next. The storytelling is so clear here, in words and in pictures. you know, I had no struggle here, and there's a lot going on. It's very busy. So they did a wonderful job in the storytelling with this issue. You know, it'd be one thing if it was all 9 panel grids. That's really easy to follow, but they break that up eventually and things get hectic. And I never got lost at any point in the story. So congratulations on that.
No, you make a great point. You really do. I mean, there's 10 panels on some, there's less. Yeah. The storytelling is immaculate, which is wonderful. All right. One more comment on letters. Sorry. Since we're talking about them, there's actually some basically emoticons in some word balloons here that I got to assume are Todd Klein. Bob LePan doing it. Like on page 20, you know, Dan has an emoticon of a light bulb going off. Yeah, that's actually his thought balloon, is a light bulb going off on page 20. And then on page 23, the last page, he's asleep in the car and he has a thought balloon of a log being sawed. Again, that's got to be Bob LePan putting that in there. It's got to be. And oh, and the sound effects. So part of this is coloring. Part of this is the letter, but like they have sound effects for like snore when they're sleeping, or there's a sound effect for the word whoosh that I guess this is the colorist decide to make it rainbow color, which actually makes it look a lot more fun back on page 8. So there's a lot of fun stuff going on with it in the backgrounds here in small little places that just make it a joy to really sit here and go again, panel by panel.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I do, you know, being snarky is like, hey, it's a rainbow when it was just a rainbow. You know, nobody was going to write in any letters of complaint that just this one sound effect was a rainbow for no good reason. No reason whatsoever. Just rainbows are pretty. Let's just do a rainbow.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's because they're riding the Trident at that point. And I don't think Nebarosa's infusion of magic is what made it into a rainbow. Like you said, sometimes it just looks nice.
I got to say, too, I mentioned about, you know, this panel has more of a Cullen's balance. This panel has more of a Cologne balance. One thing I really like with Dan in this issue is he has a lot of moments where he's just kind of off to the side talking to people. And you can see sort of like he's not performing. He's not puffing up his chest. He's kind of like having to punch down a little bit because everybody's shorter than him. And he's just kind of humble and human. And you can definitely see the Dan inside the suit. And I think a lot of that is specifically Cologne, because we don't see as much of that. Like Cullen's lets Blue Devil be on all the time, and I love that. I love he's a showman and we're having fun with this stuff, but it's really nice and different and interesting seeing Cologne go in there and do this more human, more humble Blue Devil, you know, in random panels, just a little extra humanity. I wish we'd seen a little bit more. Like I'm expressing some frustration about not getting the full Cullen's, but at the same time the intermingling is really interesting, and I do wish we'd gotten some more issues with Cologne because he's great at doing Blue Devil.
It's really enjoyable. This is a great issue. So you mentioned you don't love Lenny and George coming back. How do you feel about Smitty and Rojek?
I don't even remember them being in the future books.
Oh, I don't know for sure. I don't even remember George and Lenny being in future books. I'm assuming Smitty and Rojek come back. Oh, I know. In fact, I know they do. I remember who they come back with. They're just two henchmen that were henchmen for Metallo. Now they're here trying to rob a casino, and then they'll be a henchman for someone else later on. I just find it funny. I guess, my memory is fading here, but I remember when we interviewed Dan Mishkin and Gary Cohn, they said that I'm pretty sure they were a nod to Abbott and Costello, if I remember correctly, or maybe it's Laurel and Hardy, but they're just supposed to be kind of a funny double act, and I enjoy seeing them here.
That's one of those that the first time I read it and in successive readings, I just don't catch it. I'm going to rely on you to help keep me abreast of these gentlemen.
Okay. All right. So you don't remember them from issue 3?
I remember them now that you mention it, but I would have never made the connection if you hadn't pointed it out to me, to be honest with you.
And so the editor's notes that say "See Blue Devil number 3 with the characters don't mean anything to you?
You know, I read this issue because we talked about reading this issue, and then I immediately read the issue, and then we're recording it like a month and change later. Okay. So if that was there, I forgot about it or missed it.
Yeah, I mean, the Blue Devil even says, like, wait a minute, I know you too. And it says, see Blue Devil number 3. But okay, Frank, that's fine. glad you're on the
book. You get the benefit of recency bias.
I guess so. One thing we didn't really talk much about is there is a page here. This is all foreshadowing for the next issue, where the trickster is in a seedy motel and he's getting ready to leave. And suddenly a new bad guy, very first appearance of a new bad guy named Bolt, who shows up, and Trickster has to get out of there by using his airwalking shoes and a smoke screen. So what do you think about Bolt in general and Trickster here?
Well, I mean, I want to say my Bolt opinion is for the Bolt issue, but okay. It is cool. I didn't remember him debuting, because this is his comic book debut, correct?
Yeah, this is it.
Yeah, I did not recollect that he came in as a subplot in this issue. I always remember him within the next three issues. He definitely makes an impression. And I'll be honest with you, too. I don't think I made the connection when I read this book. I know they call him the Trickster, but I did not get to read the preview in sequential order. So I had not read the preview by the time I read this issue, and I was not very familiar with the Flash or his rogues. So I would have definitely like, oh, there's Bolt. Who's this blonde guy, the Trickster? I've never heard of that guy. So
I could see that. Yeah. If you missed the preview issue, yeah, that would make total sense. Now, something else we should probably mention here is I always mistakenly thought this was a double-sized issue, partially because I loved the issue, and to me, this is like a huge one to be celebrated because it's great, but as we get into the actuality of it, no, it's a regular-sized issue. It just has stapled in the middle this giant Flash Force 2000 insert. So, were you a Flash Force 2000 fan, Frank?
So I have a story. I've told it on my Comic Reader Resume podcast before, so I'll try to give you a quick short version. I don't recall the Flash Force 2000 story, because I can't say for sure when exactly I got this comic at the flea market. But what I can say is that overall it has a pretty good kit. Like, we didn't have a lot of money, but a few times a month, you know, I'd get an action figure or a comic book. And, you know, that was just like, okay, I'm a good kid, I get an action figure, right? Well, this one instance, we're at Kmart, and I'm just fascinated by the idea of shooting a car with a cap, you know, this explosive cap, like a cap gun. And I never cared much for cars. I did have some of the cars that they made in the 70s where, like, I think there was a Hulk van where you look through the back window mm-hmm. and you saw an image of the Hulk inside. I think I had a Spider-Man one or something like that. But I was never a huge car guy. But for some reason, just the idea, the novelty of it, I was just fixated on. And so I asked, hey, can I have this? And my parents said yes. And it's like, great. And so I've got my toy and I'm ready to go. And then they turn around, they say, actually, no, you can't have that after all. And I'm like, why? What did I do? Why can't I have it? I was just, and I actually ended up busting out crying in the Kmart to the point where my mother escorted me outside. And I was just like, I just couldn't understand. What did I do? Why did you say yes? And then you say, no, I don't understand it. And she told me, no, your grandmother wants to buy you that for Christmas. She didn't know what to get you. Now she knows what to get you, but you can't have it now. You're going to get it later. And once I knew, understood why, I was like, okay. And then I just felt bad. And I wasn't prone to that. I cried like every kid cries, but I didn't throw tantrums. And I didn't like expect much. I didn't have a bike or anything like that. I just, every now and again, I wanted like a cap firing car. So, but I understood. I waited Christmas. I got it at Christmas. I opened it up. Those caps didn't work for nothing. So all of that build up and this, all I had was this crummy car, and I had no use for car and just went right back to playing with my action figures, which I should have been doing in the first place.
Well, thank you, Flash Force 2000.
Well, I was thinking of another thing to say to Flash Force 2000, but I'll go with thank you since this is an all ages show.
There we go.
But I just want to share that I was shamed and embarrassed by my behavior related to the Flash Force 2000 phenomenon.
I did not realize that the Flash Force 2000 could have such an impact on America's youth to create such awful behavior in children. It's that's the power. That's the power of merchandising right there, man.
It was the difference between little child Jekyll and child Hyde. What can I tell you?
All right. Well, we have talked this issue over and over and over. Obviously, we both agree it's one of the greatest issues of all time. And we're 100% on the same page with that. And there's absolutely no differences between us. So, Frank, this is the point where we are going to nominate the Weirdness Magnet. So this can be any moment from the issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that made you laugh, whatever. What would you pick as your Weirdness Magnet for this issue? Because there's a lot of good choices, actually.
So this is another instance where there's a combination. So the thing with Norm is he is a regular dude, a straight thinking guy amongst all these goofball Hollywood types. And even Dan, who was a stuntman, a tech guy, he still is getting drug into this fantastical world. But he can't help it. He's 7 foot tall and blue, right? So he's someone who's not going to take dumb chances. He's not some kind of daredevil. He's not some thrill seeker. But he's a cameraman who has a passion for getting those incredible shots that nobody else has ever gotten. And when he sees an opportunity to get out there and get something perfect in his lens, he's going to take it. And I think that gives him such dimension because, you know, you've got that weight of like, yeah, I know what I should be doing, but this shot, man, I can't miss the shot. There's a demon in the Aztec ruins. I've got to get this shot. And I just love how game Norm is. And it makes sense pairing him with Dan because they just play off of each other because they're both kind of blue collar, but they're also in fantastical fields and dealing with fantastical circumstances. And so he's just a great guy, great wingman for weirdness magnet adventures. So I love that. And then, I really enjoy seeing Cologne draw Blue Devil. And I wanted to see him do this more on his own. Like that shot of Bolt is really cool and different. It doesn't look like the Bolt that I've seen elsewhere, but I dig it. And while I don't get Bolt in the splash page, you get a little bit of everything. I got my Paris Cullen's itch scratched. I got my Cologne scratched. I got my Norm moment. I got Blue Devil looking Blue Devil-y the way I want him to and just relishing his abilities. So yeah, for me, it's all in that splash page. The rest of the issue is just gravy. I could buy this book for just the splash.
I totally get that. It's a fantastic page. It's absolutely stunning. There's so many moments I considered, like, you know, maybe even just the moment where Norm comes up with a weirdness magnet idea. Like, you know, that would be kind of a fitting pick for this time. Or at the end, when Dan and Norm are reunited with the other supporting characters, there's a moment where Sharon just is so in love with Dan. She comes running across the street to him, slams into him with an enormous hug. It's like every guy wants their girl to look at them like Sharon does Dan. I mean, it's just like, I look at that and you're like, man, I just wish my wife would look at me like that sometimes. Or your splash page. What I'm ultimately going for is not so much anything in the art, it's more a scene. And that's pages 14 and 15, where just it gets insanely chaotic, because that's what I love, is where, again, they're in the casino, Blue Devil's got all these adoring fans, Lenny and George attack them, they fight, the slot machines go over, there's coins everywhere, Smitty and Rojek are trying to collect the coins, then the robot guards show up. It's just so chaotic, so crazy, and funny that I just love those two pages, because I love so much chaos in the book. It brings me a lot of joy. So both are great moments. Both, I think, are exemplary reasons to love the Blue Devil book. And I think they both deserve to win the weirdness magnet this issue. All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it for our coverage of Blue Devil number 6. We are going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we are going to dive into your feedback from Blue Devil number 5.
My own father dressed like they did in I Spy. He had a skinny belt and a skinny tie.
In 2018.
Oh, we believe the secret agents had all that stuff, man. And some of that stuff did exist. The scopes on the guns and Man from U.N.C.L.E. They were supposed to be infrared scopes, and they were.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
My son comes over with his microphone and his digital board and computer, and he wants to bond over things, and since we both watch films, that's what we bond over. Started out to be over James Bond, but he heard somebody else was doing that. So we're bonding over any kind of spy.
Secret Agent Man, Wild Wild West.
The Avengers was on American TV, but it didn't go over. It's not really something I think most Americans could understand. British invasion may have begun, but America had to catch up to the humor of it.
Bonding Agents, the father and son spy-fi podcast.
Spy-fi?
Your assets.
Old dude.
Bialy Frank.
And the program's about whatever he tells me it is. Spies and science fiction all rolled up into one.
Available through Shout Engine and the Internet Archive, through iTunes, and similar podcatchers.
The most provocative part of our man Flint is the fact that he lives with like 5 women. That is what would bend people. Anybody watching the movie at that time would be going, oh, whoa.
Bonding Agents is a Rogue Spine podcast.
Two months only, Halloween Hoedown at the house of Frankenstein.
Your favorite Halloween party returns with 4 brand new episodes featuring cinematic horror classics and horror-filled superhero tales starring Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man.
Pin the bandage on Boris Karloff as the mummy.
You will not remember what I show you now, and yet I shall awaken memories of love and crime and death.
Do the locomotion with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing on the Horror Express.
Are you telling me that an ape that lived 2 million years ago got up to that crate, killed the baggage man, and put him in there?
Yes, I am. It's alive. It must be.
Bob for Apples with Hammer's The Reptile.
Get away from there! Get away!
jam to the blues at this juke joint full of sinners.
We're going to kill every last one of you.
This September and October, join the Supermates at firewaterpodcast.com for the most happening haunt this side of the mausoleum, the House of Frankenstein. Halloween Hoedown!
All right, we are back for Speak of the Devil, which is our own version of the Blue Devil letter column. Now, it's still called Circuits and Sorcery up through issue 6, but according to the letters page, actually issue 7 is when they're going to begin calling it Speak of the Devil. So there we go. So we are covering your feedback from Blue Devil number 5. These are comments that were left on the Fire and Water Podcast website. We're just going to be pulling bits and pieces of your comments to share in the air. Remember, if you want to be read in the next episode, be sure to leave your comments on the website. All right, we're going to start off with Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, plus the Legion Super Bloggers. He says, another great episode, but if there's ever a show begging for a supplemental post, it's this one. As I was listening in the car to how great the art was, I kept telling myself, I can't wait to go home and look, only to be left hanging. All is well, I bet it's on the app. I mentioned it earlier, Dr. Ange. Yes, so I always try to post the relevant comic panels on social media. Again, you can check the show notes for this episode. There'll actually be links to Blue Sky and Instagram, where you can go over there and look directly at those images. So then Dr. Ange continues. We had speculated last episode, Frank, about some statted photos. There were like, they're in Warner Brothers Studio. There was a photo of a woman and a photo of a man that were statted in, and we were speculating who they would be. He says, as for the studio photos, I thought for sure it was Stephanie Powers, but now hearing Frank say it's Jeanette Kahn, that has to be right. Incredible. And then also last issue, I was just trying to understand why Nebaros could get more power from the Trident. It just wasn't making sense to me. So he says, lastly, the Nebaros getting more power from the Trident when he picks up the staff he imbued with power makes complete sense from a Lord of the Rings view. Sauron made the One Ring with his own power, but I think it makes him even more powerful than he was. Perhaps the other magics utilized to form the weapons augments the powers put into it? Maybe so, Dr. Ange. Hey, I will trust you on the Tolkienisms. Then he says, I first got into Cullen's work with his work on Blue Beetle, and I always thought Bruce Patterson was the perfect inker for his stuff. Well, I would agree, Dr. Ange. Bruce Patterson's a great inker. I think Gary Martin is the perfect inker for him. So
I concur. And Bruce Patterson is a great inker. I love his stuff, especially on Pat Broderick. But I think that Gary Martin is definitely the peak Cullen's inker.
I think on the Blue Beetle book, and I don't mean to be critical of another book, but I feel like Bruce Patterson's work there, like something was always off with the eyes for me in the Blue Beetle book. I can't explain it. That whenever I think about that book, that is the first thing I think of, are the eyes were just never right. And it's always stuck with me. I don't know. Anyway, Martin Gray chimes in about the statted photos as well. He says, nah, it's Stephanie Powers with James Gardner. He goes, in jokes are great, but it makes no sense for the story. And Dick Giordano always had a mustache. So he's saying that statted photo had to have been Stephanie Powers and James Gardner. I still think it's Stephanie Powers because it sure as heck looks like her.
Let's just say that people have been sued for less. So I would question if any Grant got a payday because somebody just drew her likeness without her consent. So actually statting in a likeness of a name actor, I mean, I don't think people were quite as litigious back then, but I don't know about that one.
All right. Well, why don't you read us the next comment?
So this is from Dr. Robert Gross. Dr. Robert, I don't recognize his name. Is this somebody who's commented before?
Oh, yeah. He's a major Firestorm fan. He and I have been buddies for a long time. In fact, he guest starred on my V podcast, the ones that went 4 hours long. He was the music expert because he is a composer by trade. And so he was on there and just shared amazing, fascinating information about the V soundtrack.
I listened to those episodes. I contributed to those episodes, but I cannot remember the full roll call. So I'm glad we managed to work in a plug inadvertently. So Dr. Robert Gross wrote, fantastic episode, random thoughts. The word slake sounding like a dirty word was a joke on a MASH episode 2. I also thought Dick Giordano for the male picture. I have no idea what Jeanette Kahn looks like, but that sounds completely plausible. I'm ambivalent about magic in comics. I think that magic offset by science, circus and sorcery, can be fun. However, as it is in Blue Devil, I don't like things like Greek Norse myths are actually real because it just takes my suspension of disbelief too much.
He's not going to like the issue of the Furies then.
Yeah. It taxes my suspension of belief too much. I get that because, again, it's very precarious. You want just enough weirdness to believe that these are still professionals in Hollywood who would engage with this stuff willingly or by circumstance. Whereas, yeah, when you start getting into Greco-Roman myth, it's one of those things where Batman doesn't believe in the supernatural. Really? Are you sure about that? It's a little hard to buy. I get you.
If you live in a universe with the Spectre and you team up with people like Phantom Stranger, you kind of have to believe in the supernatural. I'm sorry.
Well, I think they've come up with the explanation that Batman chooses not to believe because he believes that it disempowers these forces. So as a sort of like a reverse psychology or reverse supernaturality, I can kind of see where he's coming from there. But if you look at it logically, it's like, dude, come on. The Earth is also round.
Right.
So exploding bubbles sounds like an animation from a detergent ad. But yeah, cool power they keep using. It's different. Agreed. Yeah. Lila acting like an adolescent in her reaction to Blue Devil's muscles. Maybe Lila rapidly aged like Alex Luthor and was not yet mature at this point, which, yeah, she's got the whole Donna Troy origin where he just scoops her up out of the sea, right? We got no idea of knowing what he did.
We'll have to get Doug Adamson and DC Dave from the Monitor Tapes podcast to chime in on that.
I hadn't realized that Zatanna was routinely sidelined, but it makes sense. Otherwise, she'd be way too powerful for most situations. Kind of like a certain Nuclear Man around the same time. Yep, sounds about right.
Speak your truth.
I love the 80s costume too, but it is quite 80s. I think I get why they don't use the Blue Devil iconic costume today. It's a little dated.
Remind me to scratch Dr. Gross from my Christmas card list. Thanks.
Right. Plunge another dagger in my heart. Why don't you? Martin can take turns. I can beat you. Which one of you is Claudius? Okay. That said, the less said about what modern writers did to Dan Cassidy's character or his alleged lack thereof, the better.
Yeah.
And then finally, Tim Curry is not a letdown after Bobcat Goldthwait. Not at all. And look, they're both, I mean, I'm going to stand behind Bobcat, but yeah, nobody's going to kick Tim Curry out of a voice casting session. Come on.
Right. So that's in reference to who he cast for the voice of Nebros last time. I am very pleased with my Tim Curry pick, but once you said Bobcat Goldthwait, I'm like, that is the most brilliant answer ever. Nothing can ever compete with that. That's just genius. There were a few other social media comments about the statted photos. Some people suggested the guy could be Johnny Cash or even Rich Little. I do see a little bit of Rich Little in the photo, or Paul Levitz. And then someone suggested the woman could be Michelle Lee. So those are just rounding it out some of the other thoughts on who those statted photos could be. They were from M.A. Salko from the podcast Kids in America, a Molly Pitcher and Betsy Ross podcast. As Salko says, hot take, Dr. Fate's half mask look is actually better when it comes to Golden Age JSA stories. The art at the time wasn't as great at making the full helm expressive. Also, the Atom and the Hawkman were already doing the full mask thing. Full helm is clearly the way to go from the Silver Age forward. Interesting. I hear what you're laying down, and I get what you're saying. You can see the mouth. It's kind of a John Pertwee Doctor Who reference, which I know you get, Salko, where he says that he likes to see part of the face. But that full helm, it just looks so incredible. I don't think anything could beat it. But that's just my two cents.
I think that's one of those situations where commercially, Dr. Fate would probably be a better selling character if he wore the half helm, but that would be because he'd be doing the thing that everybody else does, and that's not why people who like Dr. Fate buy Dr. Fate comic books.
I mean, yeah, I mean, let's think about it. The superpowers action figure for Dr. Fate, it sold alone just because that helmet looks so different. I mean, that's the only reason that figure sold, and everyone loves it for that reason. So,
but I do think, as we discussed this, we're kind of mischaracterizing. He specifically said in the Golden Age because of how they were drawing things in the Golden Age. So I'm sure he loves the full mask too, just not in that setting. And he is a more classical, appealing, like mass appealing figure in the Golden Age with the half helm. So I get where he's coming from on that.
That's fair.
I don't want to misrepresent what he's saying.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely fair. And because I've got that Dr. Fate Archives edition, and you're right. The art is of such a style that the half mask is a little more impressive than they were drawing back then. That's absolutely fair. Good call. Then Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel, that introduction, when Frank was reading it, I kept imagining the Muppet Show with special guest, the Blue Devil. Now I want a Muppet version of the Blue Devil.
Now I want the same.
That's yeah, awesome. Now I do too.
I'm figuring what parody the Blue Devil would do with this piggy. Yeah, make that happen.
Well, I'm just also picturing like the same kind of fur they use on Sam the Eagle for Dan. I mean, this could really work. I love it.
Let's turn this AI slop into something of value. Make that happen. Go drain a lake and give me a little video of that.
Oh my gosh. All right, who's next?
So Martin Gray of the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog writes, "Meanwhile, we had this episode and it was great. Love the banter as ever. The issue itself was a lot of fun. You cannot go wrong with Dan and Zatanna together. It's weird. Our favorite backwards magician is totally in that summer fun annual in my memory. I am so brain dead." She would definitely fit. You know, you would expect her to be there, but not so much.
Yeah, it's shocking to look back and realize she's not.
In part because if they had had her in the annual, things needed to happen. And by that point, the relationship with Sharon had progressed to the point where things couldn't happen. So probably for the best. "I disagree that it was bad form on the part of the cover colorist to make the soldiers in the background all gray. Look at the rest of the colors on the cover. If the wee fellas were colored in full as well, it would just be one enormous guttle," he says. I've not seen the word guttle before. Maybe muddle? As Frank intimated, but Martin has a vocabulary that's all his own or all his of his country's been zoned. I don't know what a guttle is, but that's a thing. As Frank, it's all pants. What can I tell you? It's all pants. As Frank intimated, there'd be nowhere for the eye to land. I don't think Paris Cullens put that much work into this area. All we get is a little bit of rubble or machinery and five titchy soldiers, not much to lose.
I got to tell you, I'm right there with Martin on this. Like, it's the same thing with this cover. I think they made the right call not coloring in all the details. I really did. And Martin, you're absolutely right. We don't see eye to eye on everything, buddy. And I love you to death. And we're eye to eye on this one.
Well, the funny part is he's agreeing with me, though.
Well, he's saying that the colorist it did the right thing by making them all want a similar color in the background.
Carrying on, "I was amused by the comments on Lila. Someone should address her weirdness in a podcast." Yeah, somebody should really get into that crisis stuff. Do we know anybody who's doing that?
I don't know. I mean, I did mention someone a minute ago, but I've already forgotten their names.
It must have been something that went out of continuity.
Exactly. Exactly. The antimatter wave caught them and erased Doug and Dave from history.
"Frank, you're right. I am out of my mind, but not when it comes to Blue Devil's costume. I told you this was coming." "And I didn't even mention those appalling old man bushy eyebrows, the ones I was just complimenting."
Exactly.
"How can anyone possibly fancy him looking like that? I do think he looked rather smart in his shadow-packed black t-shirt and jeans affair." And all I'm going to say is if you look at the yellow areas on this issue's cover, there's some areas of interest for some folks of certain persuasion that might they're mentioning.
I'm just saying the blue and yellow traditional costume is like his Facebook costume. Yes, but like the black shadow back black t-shirt and jeans is like maybe his Tinder photo. So I get where you're going for Martin, but I'm the Facebook guy, right? So I'm okay with the big Gehring colors and the big eyebrows and all that. I love it.
And what I'm getting at is that maybe we should fan cast John Hamm as Blue Devil, at least for this cover. As Frank says, it's Seamus, not Seamus, but some of the names on this side of the pond are indeed a little strange. Have you ever tried to pronounce, oh Lord, I warned you guys about this, Cholmondeley or Feth Stonehaw? Oh my God. You guys are going to have to read this. That's the best I can approximate. They're sounded as Chumley and Fanshawe.
Which makes no sense. I mean, the spelling is insane for those pronunciations. That's crazy. Your people are crazy, Martin.
Some of those people ended up here because if you ever look at the spelling of Kirkendall, you'll never figure that one out either. And I work with a woman named Siobhan, and the Irish version of that is not what you would think it would be.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's right.
Finally, Tim Curry is a great idea for Neveros. As for Norm, any comedic U.S. chap would do.
So
I'm going to say Bill Burr. We'll have Norm be played by Bill Burr.
Yeah, any comedic chap that is totally not fair, Martin. That is totally not fair. In fact, we're going to fan cast Norm in just a minute, so you'll hear our thoughts on that.
I'm teasing him. I went with a total comedic U.S. chap on my selection, so just foreshadowing.
Then we're over Mark Baker Wright from Not Your Father's Autobot podcast and the Black Rocks Toy Box. Mark says, when you guys were fan casting, I was conscious of your criteria that Neboros' voice actors needed to bring a combination of gravitas and craziness to the role. When Shag suggested Tim Curry, I was reminded of my own fan casting in the 90s, whereby I always thought Curry would make a great version of the Master from Doctor Who for exactly those reasons. Mark, that is genius. He would have been a fantastic, like in an animated version of the Master in the 90s, he would have been amazing. Then he says, it's hard to beat Frank's suggestion of Bobcat Goldthwait for Neboros, though. I mean, yeah. I mean, I immediately seceded and said, yeah, that's it. Genius. So.
Yeah.
Was that you doing Bobcat, or was that you just shocked that I agreed with you? I can't tell. Or do you have an aneurysm?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can't do it. I'm trying. No.
Stop.
I'm shooting for Bobcat. I sound like Cornholio instead.
Right. Yes, you do.
I mean, thinking from my bunghole. Okay, so Nate the Gray caps this off. He said, I tend to think Bruce Campbell for Nevarose. As for Satana, Serenda Swan was good as her on Smallville, but I think Camila Mendez from Riverdale would work too. I honestly think they're both a little too catty. Like there's a little bit of an aggressive quality to both of those actresses. And I think Zatanna's a little bit more girl next door. She's more Betty, less Veronica. And both of those choices, I think, are Veronica's.
Interesting.
Literally.
Right. I like Bruce Campbell for Nebros. That's it. That would be a completely different take than what I was going for. It would be a lot more over the top kind of wow kind of factor. But he could be fun. Bruce Campbell's amazing guy. Could do a lot of different stuff.
Bruce Campbell is Dan Cassidy.
Ooh, wow.
Like literally, he basically, like, the life he lived doing the Evil Dead movies and stuff.
Yeah.
He literally is Dan Cassidy.
Oh, he's got the chin and everything. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's pretty good. I like that. Speaking of casting, it is time for the casting couch. Previously, we have fan casted Dan Cassidy, Marla Bloom, Wayne Tarrant, Sharon Scott, and Nebarose. And now it is our turn to fan cast for Norm Paxton, cameraman extraordinaire. Now, should we give everyone a rundown of all the people we fan casted so far, or should we just jump into this?
I mean, you've got the list here, which, by the way, thank you for that. It's very handy. It's up to you, though.
I'll do it one time. I'm not going to do this every time, folks, but just to get it, because we've gotten pretty far along. So for Dan Cassidy, I picked Kurt Russell from the 1980s in the Big Trouble Little China era. You picked Bill Hader from Saturday Night Live.
For Marla Bloom, Shag went with Candace Bergen in her Murphy Brown era, whereas I went with Caroline DeVerna.
I'm glad you picked that one because I don't know how to say her last name. Then for Wayne Tarrant, I picked Luke Wilson from the 1990s, and you picked Justin Timberlake.
For Sharon Scott, you picked Kate Capshaw in her Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom era, whereas I went with Kaylee Cuoco.
And honestly, Kaylee Cuoco is a great casting for that character. Really is. Nebarose, we already talked about it. I picked Tim Curry from any era, and you picked Bobcat Goldthwait, which also is another genius casting. However, this time I've got you, Frank.
I know you do, because nobody's going to even know who I'm talking about.
I Googled them, so. But we are casting Norm Paxton, cameraman extraordinaire. Why don't you go first, because I'm going to wow you with my pick.
Yeah, you're going to annihilate me, I know. So, first thing I did was I put myself in your shoes, and as much as you try to fight it, you're still the 80s Blue Devil movie guy in my brain. Mm-hmm. So the person I picked for the 80s Blue Devil movie would be Charlie Robinson from Night Court. I think he's got big Norm energy, right?
Oh, you're talking about Mac from Night Court?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really good. I like that. I mean, you see, the hair is the same. He's even got the glass. Oh, wow. The cardigans, I mean, not that Norm wore the cardigans, but Mac is really good. Wow, I'm jealous. I hadn't thought of that one. Okay.
So I agree with Martin Gray. I do think that you want a person with comedy chops to play Norm. And so I was looking at the various comedians. The guy that I felt had the most vibes was a fellow named Brian Simpson, but he's really obscure and he does not have any significant acting credits. So I ended up going with my second choice so that somebody might actually know who I'm talking about. I chose Little Rel Howery. Rel actually had his own TV show at one point in time, and he's got a lot of acting credits. But the thing that most people will remember him from is the movie Get Out. He's the guy with the airport security who ends up, I don't want to spoil the movie for you, but he's the one person who's looking out for our hero and trying to protect him from the things that happen in the movie. He's my guy for Norm.
Well, I knew him from Free Guy. He plays Ryan Reynolds' best friend, right? In that one?
You're right. He was in Free Guy. That's correct.
That's where I knew him from. Was he a cop or I can't remember what his something. He was wearing a uniform of some sort. I can't remember what his role was, but he was his best friend. So I remember that character from there. He was good. He's fun. I don't see him as the action side of Norm. I mean, we had an issue or two ago where Norm was parachuting in. He's got a camera in one arm and a pistol in the other, and he's shooting demons. I mean, Norm's got to have some action chops.
It seems like in the movies they play up him being kind of on the heavier side. When you see him in stand-up, you see he's actually got a pretty decent build on him. He just, like most of us, has a belly going on. So
okay, all right, so my pick, here we go. When we started fan casting, however long ago we started these podcasts, I don't know, a couple years ago, I knew immediately my Norm right out of the gate. Everyone else has been a struggle for me to come up with Norm. I knew from jump. And Norm is going to be played by Keith David, which the name may be meaningless to you folks because it's kind of a generic sounding name. However, this guy has been acting since 1979. He's got over 400 acting credits. If you were to Google Keith David and see a picture of him, you go, oh my gosh, yeah, I know that guy. I mean, he was in The Thing. He was in They Live. He was in Platoon. He's in Armageddon. He was in Community for a season. He's been in a million things. And I would pull him out of, like, say, the 1990s when he was a little bit younger, but not super young, and put a set of glasses on him. And he is absolutely the action Norm. And he's perfect. And he can do comedy. He can do action. He can do badass. All of it. He is the whole package. Keith David.
I love Keith David. He's Spawn. He's Despero. He's another one of those guys like Tim Curry. You can't go wrong with Keith David.
All right. So I feel like there's a little bit of hesitation in there, in your voice there, but you better be 100% on board with this.
The man is currently 69 years old, and in the 80s, well, I already picked my 80s version, so.
Right, yeah. I mean, but, that's a pretty good pick.
No, Keith David's another one of those dudes, though. You can't go wrong. He's going to give you a great performance. He's got such a wonderful, distinctive voice. He was in, I remember him from Men at Work. You know, he was obviously in The Thing. He was in They Live, so he's got the 80s bona fides if you're going to put him in the 80s or early 90s. So, yeah, you can't go wrong with Keith David.
He's so good. And the voice, you're right. That voice is fantastic. It's like butter. Ugh. All right, Frank, so we have passed quite a few of our friends here. So who are we picking next for the casting couch?
Well, we've done nothing but friends for the most part, with the exception of Nebaros. It's probably time for us to start dipping into the villain bag.
Okay.
So how about the Trickster?
Ooh, that's a fun idea. Okay. Yeah, I'm down with that. I love it.
What's interesting with that, too, is we actually have Tricksters who have been cast. So we have literal actors we can work against. Like, okay, do we want to go with somebody who's played him in the past? Or we want to just go somebody who's the opposite of somebody who played him in the past? So none of these other people have really had media representation. So this will be the first time where there's an actual competition with real casting directors and the like.
Let me dig my own grave right now. While I love the 1990s Flash TV show, while I love Mark Hamill, I do not like his portrayal of the Trickster. So there we go. You guys, send your hate mail to Once Upon a Geek.
Let's be honest. We all know that the whole point of the Trickster was to be the prototype for the Joker, and he's the greatest Joker ever. So if he's so identified with the Joker, how can we have him be the Trickster? He can't be both the Trickster and the Joker. That's against the law.
But he's also not the prototype because Jack Nicholson had done it the year before. But anyway, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but is Nicholson Mark Hamill Joker? I mean, Nicholson's Nicholson. In fact, he's maybe exactly. A little too Nicholson.
Oh, he's absolutely too Nicholson as the Joker. Yeah. Absolutely. So
Mark Hamill's the one to beat.
Well, folks, start thinking now who is going to be your Trickster. You can leave it in the comments now if you want on this episode, and we will read them on next episode, and you'll hear who Frank and I pick as well. So, all right. Well, that is going to do it. Frank, thank you so much for joining me on this journey celebrating Blue Devil. It's always a blast. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you, buddy?
Well, I mentioned running the Bonding Agents promo, in part because that one hasn't played before, but also because I've put out my annual episode of that show with my father a few weeks back. So that's available if folks are interested in hearing about family members pretending to be discussing James Bond, but really talking about hijinks from the 60s and 70s, right? Somebody who's a lot more adventurous than me telling a dirty store locker room stories, essentially. Most of my time of late has been essentially solo stuff. I've not been getting with my role Spawn guys as much. We're seeing each other maybe per quarter, and we get together. We're not really wanting to record a podcast. And DC Secret Files has been very effort intensive. So I'm not even hitting weekly releases anymore, but that's like the big thing that I'm doing. Shag was on a recent episode, did a great job. I did have him get kidnapped by Federales, and he's currently being held hostage somewhere in the meta narrative. So if you want to look out for Shag's well-being, go listen to that show. The other two solo things I'm doing regularly are Dark Horse Presents Aliens and Terminator Now. And hopefully we can get the guys doing more stuff in the future, but none of us had the time or energy to do anything. So I'm just trying my best to chug along on my own.
And they can find all those, there's the Rolled Spine feed and then the Rolled Spine 4-Color feed. Is that right?
Yeah. So if you're looking for feeds, the clean stuff that you can listen to with your family and then they'll resent you and maybe seek a divorce, that's on the 4-Color Rolled Spine clean feed. All three of those shows, two of those shows are on the clean feed, whereas Bonding Agents is filthy, and that's on the regular Rolled Spine feed.
There we go. So you know where to find your filth and where to find your clean stuff, folks. Well, thank you again, Frank. I always a blast podcasting with you, and I really enjoyed this, pal.
It would break my heart if you ever did a Blue Devil thing without me, like that time that you interviewed multiple creators that and excluded me entirely. But otherwise, I'm really glad to be here. And I'm sure my lack of enthusiasm for your casting picks has nothing to do with my seething resentment at the time you got to spend with the creators of this project that we both love so dearly. So I am still, though, deeply grateful to share this love fest with you. We love these comic books, and I would not miss a single episode for the world. Except for the one you excluded me from.
To be fair, I interviewed them like back in 2010, so we barely even knew each other at that point, Frank. But anyway,
the joke is you did a recap episode, a flashback episode, and I wasn't even in the rap.
That's true.
So you're perfectly capable of doing this without me. So I will grovel and beg to make sure that I continue to be in the episodes, at least the issues being covered.
I'll make sure to invite you back for issue 11. How's that? All right, folks. Well, I love talking about Blue Devil. Next episode will, though, be tackling a different topic. But don't worry, we will get back to Blue Devil coverage in the coming months. And what will the topic be for the next episode? Sorry, folks. You're just going to have to wait and find out. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Frank.
Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive.
Find your joy.
Can I? Life is short.
Find your joy.
Oh my God, it's Bobcat. He's back. Oh, this is going to take an hour. Okay. Mm-hmm.